Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right. Welcome to Rogue Startups, episode 121. Today, we have a special guest, Dr. Sherry Walling, who you are probably familiar with in the founder circles, who has spoken at MicroConf several times about founder mental health and issues around that. So welcome to the podcast today, Sherry. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So Sherry had a tweet recently that as soon as it went out, I was like, we need to talk about this on the podcast because this is something that we're dealing with, we as entrepreneurs, on a very, very regular basis. And that is the question of uncertainty. And our lives are basically structured entirely around uncertainty and managing that and trying to live with it. And the article that she sent out was from The Atlantic that talked about this discussion from some psychologists that were sort of delving into the issues here. And I thought that would be a great subject for us today. So with that in mind, Sherry, can you give a little bit of background on yourself or anybody in the audience who happens to be living under a rock and hasn't been to a MicroConf and doesn't know anything about you?
Or doesn't listen to Zen Founder, right?
Or doesn't listen to Zen Founder or any of the other important stuff out there they should be doing.
I think many like well-meaning, successful people probably have not heard of me, which is absolutely fine. Yeah. So I am a clinical psychologist. I have a PhD in clinical psychology and a background working in my field, mostly with people who have really high stress jobs, like people in combat, in the military, first responders, like police officers, firefighters, medics. And I've also worked a lot with physicians. So I really like working with sort of high intensity people who are really under quite a bit of pressure. And I'm also, in the other part of my life, married to Rob Walling, who is a serial entrepreneur. So I've had this sort of professional identity where I work with like stressed out people. And then I realized that like my husband and all of his friends are also experiencing a lot of intensity in their jobs. And it's made sense over the last couple of years to start to combine those worlds a little bit. So Rob and I have been for 3 years now co-hosting a podcast called Zen Founder, where we talk about mental health, the challenges of managing stress, specifically for entrepreneurs and people who are in the founder community.
Awesome. Awesome.
I have to ask about kind of bridging those two worlds, Sherry. So going, I guess it's not as much of a shift from one to the other, but really kind of merging them together. Has it been difficult to kind of bring your professional world, I'll say home, in working with Rob and people in kind of the startup and MicroConf spaces, or do you find yourself, is it difficult to kind of separate work and home and personal and things like that at this point, or has it been okay?
It tends to be okay. I think a lot of the training that goes into becoming a psychologist is, for lack of a better term, kind of about compartmentalization, like understanding which role you're playing at which time. And what has meshed is that now I do quite a bit of consulting with founders. But even then, I feel myself sort of going into like consultant role. And then I might like see them at a conference and they don't get a different version of me, but a little bit different. Because that friend relationship or this collegial relationship that I might have with someone at a conference is more egalitarian. It's more like we're both talking about our lives. But when I'm consulting with someone or when I'm working as a therapist, like my whole brain and emotional maturity, like all of my resources are really about that person. And it's not back and forth. It's not reciprocal. It's like me helping and taking care of them. So it's a really different like mental space to be in, and it's a different role. And believe me, Rob can tell the difference when like ever I kind of like drift over into therapy mode, he like gives me this look and he like
do I need to lay like, down on the couch?
like just stop, right? Like just stop. So yeah, he could feel the difference when I'm like being a wife versus when I'm being like Dr. Walling.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Well, that's great. Kudos to you to be able to sort of compartmentalize it and keep those two worlds separate. Because I think that is, I can imagine it would be a very tough thing when you start meshing two worlds it usually doesn't go well, but it sounds like it's going well for you. So that's awesome.
So far, so good.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that, you know, getting into the concept of uncertainty, I think a good kind of natural place to start is to say, why is uncertainty so kind of disconcerting for us as humans, and maybe specifically for us as like startup founders or self-employed people? What is it about uncertainty that really kind of gets to us, you think?
Yeah, I think we have to think about it from the human perspective, because from kind of an evolutionary perspective, certainty, or the ability to like automatically be able to label something and know what it is and know what to do about it, is very protective. So to like know with certainty the difference between a poisonous plant and one that's not poisonous, or to know with certainty what, you know, spots on your arm mean, is it chickenpox or is it measles or is it something else? So when we can label something and implement a plan that's already been learned, then that is like the sweet spot for our brains. Our brains know sort of which neuron path to travel, and we, without too much work, have a response to whatever we're facing in our environment. So uncertainty, when we don't know, when we can't label something, when we don't know the automatic response to something that we are faced with, that makes our brains work a lot harder. And not to call our species lazy or anything, but basically our brains don't really like that. And it's stressful. So I think that comes back to like the challenge of being an entrepreneur or someone who's in the startup space, because I think a lot of folks, certainly who have a development or programming background, know how to put building blocks together for a pretty predictable outcome. If you write the code correctly and you don't make errors, it's going to come out the way that you plan, theoretically, or like that's how it's supposed to work. But when you like make the transition into entrepreneurship, there are a lot of variables that you don't know about, that you can't perfectly predict. And the building blocks that you developed maybe as a programmer don't transfer that well to being an entrepreneur. And there's just a lot of variables that you can't compute all at one time, which causes a lot of stress.
So given that we have this, you know, tenuous relationship with uncertainty, and obviously, I wouldn't say that anybody really likes uncertainty, but one thing that's sort of an important question that I think I would want to know is, how can uncertainty lead to destructive behavior in our lives? And in specifically, are there types of people or situations to whom it's most destructive?
Yeah, I think uncertainty, when it's really distressing to someone, people have a way of kind of fictionally writing it out of the story and therefore make themselves more certain than they actually are. So I guess like one way of thinking about this is, I don't know, you are deciding what kind of marketing to use for your next app. And instead of realizing like, wow, it's been a long time since I thought about this, I don't really know what the right answer is, I'm uncertain, I'm going to go collect a bunch of data, and then ultimately I have to make a choice with no guarantee that it's absolutely the perfect choice for me or for my business at this given time. So we sort of artificially like truncate that whole process and say, this is what I did before, this is what I'm going to do again. And it really might not be the best decision, but it eliminates you from asking questions that you don't know the answer to. So what can be dangerous with uncertainty is we ignore it and we make the world more simple than we want it to be, which can lead us down all kinds of wrong paths, of course.
So to take that, I guess, to the positive side, someone who might be more successful would deal with uncertainty better because they open themselves up to uncertain situations and kind of say, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to go evaluate it and make kind of a new decision on the future of my business. And they're okay with coping with the whole process of that and what it could mean.
Sure. A tolerance for ambiguity, when we think about that from like a knowledge or a cognitive perspective, like I don't know the right answer, that naturally leads to kind of a growth mindset. Well, oh, I don't know the right answer, I'm going to go learn the right answer, and therefore, like, you know, open myself up to not knowing, but then gaining more information. Or when we feel uncertain on an emotional level, like we're ambivalent, like we are maybe equally pulled in two directions, and it's just not totally clear which path is right, then we open up for ourselves the possibility that maybe both paths are okay, or maybe one is slightly better than the other, but I have to make a decision based on what I know right now. So I'm open to being wrong. Like we pad it down for ourselves and let it be possible that we don't always know exactly what to do or how to feel in every situation.
So what would you say distinguishes someone who's better at handling uncertainty than somebody else?
I think a tolerance for ambiguity and a tolerance for not knowing.
Hmm.
Is that something that they can develop? Or is that you know, something that we're just given and you can't move the needle much on it? Maybe you can tweak it a little bit, but basically your tolerance for ambiguity is set at X, and maybe you can, you know, X plus or minus 10%. Or can you actually just be like, here are some ways that I could deal with that ambiguity better?
Oh, I think it can totally be learned. I think like the first thing is to really recognize I am uncomfortable because I don't know the right answer. Like it's having what we call metacognition, the ability to think about your thinking and realize I don't like what's happening because I am uncertain. But once you realize that, then so much of this is about like slowing the process down and letting yourself be uncertain and then be able to make, you know, decisions based on new information that you gather. So the ability to get more comfortable with uncomfortable things is totally something that most humans have the capacity to learn in lots of different domains of our lives, like sit-ups. We can get comfortable with sit-ups if you like try hard enough.
But I've done a lot of sit-ups and martial arts. I've never gotten comfortable with sit-ups. I got good at them. I never got.
But you can tolerate it. You can tolerate it.
Okay. All right. So is there like a series of steps that we can go through? Like, can you give a practical example of how somebody can improve their tolerance for ambiguity?
Yeah, sure. Just off the top of my head. So honestly, though, the first thing is to notice when you feel uncomfortable with ambiguity. Like, without that ability, there's nothing you can do. So it's like you have to stop the runaway train before you get real upset about your uncertainty and be able to realize what's happening and why. So naming the uncertainty is number one. I think number two is knowing why you are uncertain. Are you uncertain because you lack information? Are you uncertain because it's kind of a toss-up in the pro-con list for both of your options? Are you uncertain because you're emotionally pulled in two directions? So it's stopping to probe a little bit deeper into why it's difficult for you to make a decision. And then you can sort of problem solve from there. Do I need to gain more information? Do I need to seek counsel? Do I need to think through my feelings about this subject in more detail and sort of understand why I'm feeling so stuck between two or more choices? So once you understand A, that you are uncertain, B, you think about why you are uncertain, then I think you have the ability to kind of problem solve those stuck points. And then the last step in my ad hoc strategies for uncertainty is I think you really have to practice giving yourself the benefit of the doubt of I did the best I could with the information that was available. So once you are moving from uncertainty into a decision, even if you don't feel like 100% behind a decision, and many of us make lots of important decisions a day that are, you know, to some extent a crapshoot, we have to like be gracious and kind to ourselves of like, it's okay, kid, you tried your best. And when we learn to talk to ourselves that way with a little bit more like gentleness and acceptance, I think that's when we move from I'm so stressed, this is intolerable, to I can slow this down, I can think about it, and if I still don't know, I'll do my best and see what happens.
So I think that something that us as entrepreneurs of any kind are really good at is being optimistic. I think you have to be to say like, oh, I'm going to go out in the world and make it on my own with all these kind of forces against us. And like you said, every day we make a bunch of decisions that could have a really big impact on our world, and we think all of them are right. I think we do. I do. I think a lot of my decisions are right until they come up and hit me in the head. But but I think that that's also a big weakness of ours. Like we're probably overly optimistic, and we're kind of, I don't want to say arrogant, but in our decision making, maybe we're a little arrogant to think that a lot of our calls will come out right when in fact a lot of them don't. But when it comes to this kind of concept of uncertainty or ambiguity and the stress that it creates in our lives, specific to a lot of the people that would listen to this podcast, have you found with them being like your clients that there are things that entrepreneurs and people that have like startups or online businesses are better or worse at than like your typical high stress client?
I mean, I think people who do important work that matters, are by like definition of the kind of work that we do going to have to make important decisions based on imperfect information. And I think that's hard for all people who take their jobs and their work very seriously. And I think it's really challenging for people, maybe especially entrepreneurs, to strike the balance between I did the best I could and everything is going to absolutely be fine. Like, I think you're right. There is this optimism, but the balance between optimism and, hey man, there's just a lot in the world I don't know and I can't control. That's a really tough thing to walk. Because I think when we're talking about uncertainty, we're really talking about control. And those of us who have assumed responsibility for our own livelihood, like who have, you know, stepped out of the 9-to-5 life and have become rogue startups, we have assumed control for our lives. And so I think most entrepreneurs tend to believe that they have a higher level of control over what happens to them and their business than they actually do.
Yes. Yes. It's the illusion of control. You have this illusion of control until it all just comes spinning off the rails. And then you're like, oh, fuck, I didn't have any control at all.
Twitter did it.
Twitter did it.
The market. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have a new book coming out, right?
I do. Yep. Rob and I finally put together some of the material we've been chewing on in the context of the podcast for the last couple of years and sat down to write, and a lot of words came out, and voila, we have a book.
Woohoo! And because you got your shit together, the name of the book is Keeping Your Shit Together. So what you showed us the table of the contents, and it looks absolutely fantastic. As soon as you guys release it, I'm totally jumping all over this. But there were a couple of chapters that I thought really like spoke to me personally. And in the context of uncertainty, in my head, there's always this, oh God, you know, I just don't know what I'm doing, you know, and aside from imposter syndrome, but when you start with imposter syndrome, that kind of leads to, well, if you don't really know what you're doing, then maybe you shouldn't be doing this. Maybe you're not good enough. You know, you kind of get like this mind game going on where you talk yourself out of stuff. And it's really this super frustrating headspace to be in. And I feel like the only thing I can ever do is just sort of shout to myself like I'm insane. Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
That's not very nice, Dave.
It's not. But, you know, if those thoughts are coming up, like that's been a strategy that I've used in the past. And to a certain extent, I would say that it works. But it looks like your chapter 4 kind of like talks about all of these games in your head that come as a result of stress and uncertainty. So can you talk a little bit about this? Because it seems like this is a very common problem with entrepreneurs out there. I see a lot of this stuff on Twitter. A mutual friend of ours, Carrie Dills, wrote a whole article about how she, you know, self-defeats herself very easily in her freelancing business and how she has all these strategies to get out of it. I don't know if that influenced this particular chapter or if that chapter was that blog post was influenced by conversations she had with you. But obviously, this is something that we're all thinking about all the time. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it is so, this is like such a hard thing about being an entrepreneur is you don't have this agreed upon authority who has the right to evaluate your work. The way that you evaluate your work is like what feedback your customers or clients give to you and then your own appraisal of how your work is going. And then of course, I guess how big your bank account is, but it becomes very skewed in terms of like how to handle the feedback that you get, whether it's from other people or whether it's from yourself. So So yeah, this chapter is called like battling the haters in your head, because I think a lot of us have very, very critical voices in our heads, whether they come from things that people have said to us, or whether they come from our past, or whether we just concoct them ourselves. And so I like to be a little bit playful with this, actually. So one of the strategies that I do with my clients, and we talk about a little bit in the book, is like giving the negative voices in your head like a name, and even maybe an image, like giving them a visual image, a meme, or a face, or drawing them, and like having conversations with them. So you have a voice in your head that says like, your marketing strategies absolutely suck. Like, you're not good at this. You don't know how to do this. And once you give that voice a name, like, this voice is Fred, and this is a voice that lives in your head. And Fred is really kind of an asshole. And if you can imagine like talking to Fred and talking back with Fred and like defending yourself against Fred, then it gives you like a whole set of thoughts that you practice thinking that are that counter argument to whatever like hateful thought is in your head. So maybe you would say to Fred, like, hey, I'm learning this, or I'm reading this book, or I'm talking to this person, and hey, look at this strategy went really well. I tried that marketing campaign and I got a lot of conversions. You know, you can begin to do the counter argument with this hateful voice once you can separate it a little bit out and realize like it's not you, like it's not your core true self. It's just like one of the cast of characters that lives in your brain. Does that sound totally bizarre?
No, because I still have conversations with myself all the time, and not in a, you know, not in a Gollum Smeagol kind of way, but you know, more in a, is this something I should be doing? So if I'm like going through this process in my head, I literally am having a conversation with myself, trying to figure that out. And the easiest way for me to do that is to just have these voices that are going back and forth in my head to do that. And I don't think that's very uncommon. I've heard other people that have done the same process. So I don't feel like I should be locked up or put in a straitjacket, at least not yet.
For that.
Not for that, at least.
For that, right?
Not for that. No. There are probably other things that I could be locked up for. That's not one of them. But I would say that feels totally reasonable. So I think that's a great strategy.
I think our thoughts can feel really powerful. And of course, they're super important. Like, who are we without our thoughts? But sometimes we can too closely knit our thoughts and our feelings together. And we aren't as objective with our thoughts as maybe we could be or should be to help prevent us from going all in on some of these negative thoughts that live in our head that might not actually be that rational or helpful.
There's actually a very, well, I don't know how famous this is. I see it a lot here in Colorado because there's a lot of people from the Shambhala Center and other Buddhist communities around here. And of course, my wife and I have been in the Buddhist community. And there was this bumper sticker that was on a lot of our friends' cars that said, you don't have to believe what you think. And it was all about not letting the narrative in your head necessarily drive negative behavior. So if you're thinking to yourself, I'm just not very worthwhile, that's just a narrative. And you don't have to believe that. You can change that narrative. You can make it something different. And so that's not easy to remember, by the way, when you're in the middle of that narrative.
Right. Which is why like it does take some practice and some thought about it when you're not upset. To recognize kind of your triggers that signal that you're going in a bad direction. It's sort of the same with stress. Like if you know your personal like stress red flags, you can do a lot to prevent yourself from spiraling into a pretty stressed out state. But first you have to be able to pay attention, or mindful, if you want to use a different word. So when you are hearing a lot of negative self-talk, maybe there are these specific phrases that like evil dude in your head likes to say to you. You can just flag those. You just identify, okay, like evil dude is very active today and I hear him, but I don't have to believe him. Or when you begin to feel stressed, you can identify, it's been 3 nights in a row that I woke up at 2 a.m. and was unable to go back to sleep because my mind is racing. Or
how did you know? How did you
all my nails? I have been reading your journals, Craig.
Oh, it's horrible.
Just kidding.
No, so this is okay. This is the selfish part of the program. Sorry, Dave. I'm gonna take over for a minute and play patient for a few minutes. But
the Sherry, doctor is in the house.
The
so
doctor's
go for
in
it.
The house. So we're gonna get a little therapy here. But no, so I recently bought your other book, Sherry, about founder retreats, and I am planning on going to my first one. And I think this is applicable to what we're talking about because I think it is tough, especially for people who are kind of full-time on their business and not like, you know, Dave freelances some and works on his, you know, his entrepreneur business some. And I think back to when I had a day job, it was almost in some ways easier for me to kind of manage my stress because I only had like a certain number of hours a day to work. But now that I have all of the hours in the day to work, I find myself really kind of balled up in stress sometimes and just not being able to really think. Like I sit at my computer some days and I'm just like, I have 800 tabs open in Chrome and I'm trying to do all this stuff and I know it's just terribly unproductive. And so I know this is like the time when I need to take a step away so that I can get some like perspective and really think about my mindset and my headspace and my business kind of strategically. But I think I'm seeing that for the first time kind of firsthand, I guess, that like I am too in my business probably and not kind of getting that higher level picture to where I can evaluate not just like the strategic things, but like the stress and the stressors in my business and my life. I don't know. You want to talk a little bit about not me specifically, but kind of what you see with people that are kind of going through similar things.
He's asking for a friend.
I'm asking for a friend. Yeah,
you heard this guy. Yeah, I think that's one of the most distressing things about being an entrepreneur is trying to figure out what's most important. It really comes back to the uncertainty conversation and the relationship between uncertainty and stress. You know, like, if you sat down each day with like, okay, these are the three things that must get done, that's so much simpler than having like 800 tabs and, you know, a to-do list that feels kind of overwhelming and not really well parsed in terms of priority. And I do think that's what is helpful about something like a retreat is to get out of the minutiae and the day-to-day and step back and sort of say, what are my priorities and what needs to get done when, and how do I mobilize my energy around the things that are most essential to my business? Because I think it's really easy to let all things have equal weight if we don't have a really good sort of self-reflective system to figure out what is most important in a given day, in a given week, in a given month, et cetera.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm very much looking forward to taking a few days away here in the next couple of weeks, actually. And because I think it's just the right time. And I haven't felt like I really needed it, but it's probably too late now that I feel like I really need it. But I'm definitely looking forward to it. So I'll definitely be reporting back here on the show after my first one here in a couple of weeks. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you for all the insights in the book. It was really enlightening to kind of read through.
Oh, I'm glad it was helpful.
Yeah.
I'm glad it was helpful. I think retreats have been really, really essential both to Rob and I in trying to like prevent some of that day-to-day stress by having some big picture frameworks in place, at least for like a 6-month chunk of time or a year chunk of time.
So on a related note here, also asking for a friend, I think...
I don't know what those bumps are, Dave, and I'm not that kind of doctor.
Okay. All right. All right. Never mind. So it's a good thing we're an explicit podcast. That's all I can say. So the question that I would like to ask next is, you know, as a therapist, I think, and you would probably agree with this, but I'm not going to put words in your mouth about this because we've had previous discussions about this before, but specifically, I think as entrepreneurs, there is kind of a stigma with going and seeking help because as an entrepreneur, you're sort of expected to know the answers. And if you can't know the answers, you're expected to sort of figure them out on your own. And if you're seeking out certain kinds of help, like specifically psychotherapy, that's kind of it might be judged as a failure by some people. And I certainly don't hold this belief because I've had therapy before for some stressful things that were going on in my life, and I felt it was very, very helpful. But at what point would you say that it's beneficial for somebody who's an entrepreneur to go and actively seek a therapist?
Like, before they start? I mean, honestly, like...
Oh, well, shit, I'm already behind the curve. There's something else I got to put on my to-do list.
That's just more stress.
Thanks. Sorry. I know. And another way you're failing today.
Yes.
So the way that I think about it is like, so I have this hairdresser named Jesse, and I love Jesse. I walk in and I'm like, Jesse, like I'm an academic. I'm a geek. Like, I don't know what to do with my hair. Like, help me out. And Jesse's like, I got you, girl. He's like, we're going dark brown with purple stripes. And I'm like, okay. All right, Jesse. So he is like my hair expert. And I don't actually question him very much, even though he comes up with some strange things. And I actually don't know how to change the oil in my car. So I have somebody do that. And today we had people come and they shuffled our driveway because we pay for that service because it makes our lives easier. And then Rob and I don't argue so much. So like we have all these people in our lives that help us because they have some kind of muscle or training or expertise that we don't have. And so I think about a therapist in very much the same way. And I think that there are great reasons for the vast majority of entrepreneurs to have a relationship with a therapist. That doesn't mean you have to go every week and talk about your mother while you lay on the couch for the next 15 years of your life. But if you have somebody who you see every week for 6 weeks, establish a relationship, and you say, okay, doc, I'll call you when I need you, that's like a really good investment of time because there will be a time when your relationship gets rocky, when the stress gets to you in a way that you feel like you are running out of resources for. So ideally in a perfect world, if we all had great health insurance, I would just say, everybody go down there, sign up for therapists, get to know them, have them in your pocket when you need them, call them. I know that's definitely not the reality for most medical coverage, especially in the US, but it's not a bad idea just to have a sense of someone that you can go to when you do need an extra set of ears and some expertise that's beyond you.
When someone's going to look for a therapist or what kind of things should they be looking for? I mean, all therapists are not made the same. So like what kinds of things, subspecialties or areas of focus should someone kind of in our world be looking for?
There's not really a sort of distinguished subspecialty working with entrepreneurs and business owners, although I think there kind of could be. But it's great to have someone who seems to be well-trained, who from the way that they present themselves on their website, like they seem to sort of know how to use technology. I know for a lot of founders, it's super irritating to have to do everything on the phone. So honestly, just very practically, most of the entrepreneurs I know, especially in the tech space, like need to work with somebody who can function over email or can use a scheduling software and things like that just make your life easier. Those seem like details, but they kind of like become important over the long run. And then I think you want to find somebody who is close to you, who maybe does some remote consultation if that's, you know, something that's important for you if you're on the road a lot. And then the most important thing in a therapist is the sense of fit between the two of you. And I know that's not completely helpful language, but it's basically the extent to which you understand that they understand you and what you're after, the extent to which your goals are aligned. And that's a little bit hard to read in the first couple of sessions, but you tend to know it when it's not there. And I do think it's helpful to be really clear about what you're after and say like, hey, I don't have serious depression right now, but I lean a little bit that way and I am under a lot of stress and I run my own business and I'd like to be able to be proactive and get some skills to, you know, try to prevent another depression or try to prevent me from being grumpy to my wife and kids. for example. I wasn't talking about anyone.
Sure. No, no, nobody specific. Absolutely not. I'm furiously taking notes over here. So
yeah, no. Well, no, I mean, I think the last part was, I know a lot of a joke, but I mean, that's a big thing that I'm very conscious of is like, I probably can handle stress just by myself. Okay. But I do see it at times kind of, I don't want to say getting taken out on my family. And that really bums me out. And that's the time when I really say like, wow, if I'm that stressed that I can't sit at the dinner table and talk with my wife and kids or play with my kids when it's the weekend or something like that, because I'm thinking about work or I'm stressed or something like that, then it's like too far. And like, I have to give myself an intervention and I have to get some help or take some time for myself or something like that. Cause that's definitely when it's too far. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a common, like one of those anxiety red flags. Like I'm crossing over into the no-go zone when I'm super grumpy with my kids or like my youngest is very like observant and verbal and he'll like put my face between his hands and look me in the eye and be like, mama, you're not paying attention to me. Like not like to me, but like, you're not paying attention, period. It's like, oh, whoops. Okay. So anyway, I do think that it's often our relationships that are the sign that we aren't coping as well as we'd like to believe that we are.
Oh, absolutely. I was just going to throw out my own example of that is when my kids come in, I can always tell when my stress levels have passed a threshold of not good, because my kids will come in and ask me really simple questions and I'll be like, what do you want? And then afterwards, when I don't see it in the interaction, I don't catch it quite that fast. But when it's done, I'm like, oh, shit. Oh, man. Okay. I'm stressed. I got to dial it down now. And that's, you know, my indicator that maybe I should be going on a walk or getting away from the computer for a little while or deep breathing or something, because your kids shouldn't just be walking into the room and you snapping instantly. You know, that's one of those things that has come with time and experience and several conversations with my wife and family. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously stress is unavoidable as a founder and it's, you know, you're going to experience it. It's going to go up and down. But I do think that we can become way more adept than we might naturally be at recognizing it and then even working it out in our bodies, like on a physiological level, whether that's a walk or some deep breaths or just getting up. I mean, there are all kinds of skills that can help you reset physiologically so that you don't kind of fall down the mineshaft of anxiety.
So Sherry, with the Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together, How to Run Your Business Without Letting It Run You, what is, I guess, two-part kind of final question, what is your goal with this book? And who do you think it would be kind of a best fit for?
Entrepreneurs is not an answer.
Right. It's in like, the title. It's in the title.
You know, I think my goal is that this book just get in the hands of a lot of people who need to know that they are not unique in the challenges that they face as busy professionals who are under stress. So I mean, my hope for the book is that it goes pretty widespread, because I think that so many of the struggles that we experience have to do with the fact that we believe that we're unique in the things that we're struggling with. And I think, you know, this book starts out with me telling a story of how close Rob and I got to getting divorced when I think it was 2010. So we really want to like normalize the challenges that people experience and provide some like really practical strategies. So who it's for? People with tough jobs, humans, founders, their significant others. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. And it's coming to Amazon soon, or what's the launch plan looking like?
I'm waiting for the final proof. It's supposed to come today, so we'll see if the mailman can get through the 11 inches of snow that we had. So the audiobook is recorded, the book is done, and we're just waiting for some final tweaks on the printed proof. And I'm hoping that we'll have a big launch in 3 to 4 weeks, so probably mid-February. And if people want to, you know, follow the launch story, go through the launch sequence that is the stretch of my very limited marketing capacity, they can sign up to learn more about the book on zenfounder.com.
Sweet. Thank you so very much for being on here today, Sherry. This has been a great conversation. I can imagine that in the near future, when everybody gets this book in their hands, that you'll be having a lot of great conversations with a lot of other people. So thanks again.
My pleasure, you guys. Thanks for having me. It's been fun to talk to both of you.
And if you out there have any follow-up questions for Dr. Walling, we would be happy to talk about that some more. You can email us podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review in iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. And until next week.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.